Welcome to Tax Notes Talk, a podcast from Tax Notes, the leading source of tax news, information, and analysis.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm David Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of Tax Notes Today International. This week, dealer or no dealer? In November 2023, the U.S. Tax Court released its decision in YA Global Investments versus Commissioner. The decision has sparked a lot of discussion in the tax community over the court's view of a private equity company's U.S. operations. The company was found liable for over $57 million, plus penalties and interest, for failing to withhold taxes on income that was effectively connected with a U.S. trader business. So why did the court rule the way it did? And what are the broader implications raised by this opinion? Joining me now to talk more about this case and its impact is William McCray, a partner at Cleary Gottlieb. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
So could you tell us about the company at issue in this case and what they were up to?
Absolutely. So the company was called YA Global, and it was an investment fund. And it had a legal structure that's very common for a lot of private equity funds and, you know, hedge funds and similar things, which was that they had a partnership that was the entity that sort of held their investments or held their positions. And I think it had originally been formed as a Delaware limited partnership and was then re-registered into the Cayman Islands. And then for foreign investors and tax-exempt investors that perhaps didn't want to have any potential risk of effectively connected income or unrelated trader business income, things like that, they had what was called YA Offshore, which was a Cayman entity treated as a corporation for U.S. tax purposes, and that effectively served as a blocker, which means that the investors who wanted to could come into the Cayman entity. The Cayman entity would then be a partner in the partnership down below. And then if there were, let's say, for example, any ECI risk or something like that, the partnership would be the one that would file tax returns and have to pay the taxes, but the investors up above would be shielded. And that's a very sort of typical structure. Another thing that was very typical was they had a management agreement with a management company, Yorkshire Advisors, out in New Jersey. And in that sense, it was structured that, you know, I see, you know, pretty much every day. The thing that these guys did a little bit different really sort of came down to their business model and at least how the IRS was perceiving their business model. So if you think about, you know, private equity or some sort of institutional investor, almost always the name of the game is you find an entity, you know, a company that you think is undervalued, and you either buy the whole company or some kind of stake in the company. Maybe you get involved in the board, but the plan is to sell the stock that you've acquired, you know, after some years at a large capital gain. And that's really the standard model. And if you're venture capital, maybe you invest in 100 companies and you hope that, you know, two or three of them are home runs, you know, and you're kind of playing the numbers that way. But the business model is always sort of based on trying to achieve gains through investments, you know, over some period of time. What these guys did was a little bit different. They, I guess, were actively soliciting business from all sorts of portfolio companies. Their typical company that they would invest in was a public company, you know, usually not, you know, a huge company, but did have publicly traded stock. And they had a few different, you know, things they would do for the company. The first is they would make loans, a lot of the time convertible loans. And when they did that, you know, they would very much go and negotiate the terms of the loan, at least according to the way the court described it and the IRS described it, with their potential borrowers. For people who don't want to have ECI or don't want to be treated as engaged in trader business, you know, one of the big hot button issues is, you know, how do you do loan origination? How do you get in the business of making loans where you can take the view that you are an investor in debt and not someone who's engaged in a banking, financing, or similar business? And, you know, normally when you see funds that are investing in debt securities, hoping to make money, you know, they will have various incendiary guidelines about, you know, not negotiating the terms of the debt they invest in or not doing more than a certain number of loans a year so they're not, you know, continuous and, you know, in their activities, you know, things like that. At least according to the way the court was describing it, you know, these guys went and they found borrowers and they negotiated, I think they said like 202 debentures in 1 year, although it wasn't clear if that was, you know, 202 different borrowers or, you know, 202 loans made to one person, as I think Jasper Cummins had pointed out in his article recently. But they sort of had this very, you know, active approach to the way that they lent money. And then when they were in the business of buying equity, it didn't look like the kind of long-term, you know, investment model that I described. Instead, what they did was they had these things called CETAs, standby equity distribution agreements, I think is what it stood for. And the idea was when the company wanted to distribute equity, they could sell their equity to YA Global, not for a fixed price, but for a discount to the current trading price, you know, based on some kind of weighted average over some period of time. So let's say YA Global would buy it at 95% of the current market price. Then the way that they were trying to make their money, at least the way the IRS described it, was they would then flip it as quickly as they could. So if they were buying it at 95 cents on the dollar and selling it at 100 cents on the dollar, you know, that 5 cent spread was how they were making their money.
All right. So we have this sort of unusual business model this company is dealing in. What did the IRS see when they were looking at it?
Well, I think, and this is all in the 2015 CCA that came out that I think has now been sort of publicly described as describing this case. I think it's 2015-01013. The IRS basically said YA Global is not in an investment business. It's not a trader. It's an underwriter, because the way that they're making their money off of stock is by buying at a discount to the current value and then, you know, selling at the current value. And that's more of an underwriting business model. That's not investing. That's providing intermediary services, if you will. And then the way that they were doing their lending activities, you know, looked much more active, like an active lender and not just an investor in debt. And I think those were the two things that got the IRS's attention. At least that's the impression one gets from the CCA.
And so this ends up in court. What was the argument in the court?
The argument in the court came out very, very differently in terms, and there were, you know, a few different things that that happened. And I'm going to now go to the way that the judge's reasoning came out, because it was very different than I think what the IRS had been arguing. Now, the first thing that the court focused on was agency. And the reason they did this was because, as I'd mentioned, there was this management company sitting in New Jersey that was providing management services to the fund. And one of the questions is, you know, can you attribute the activities of the management company to YA Global itself? The IRS had taken this very interesting view, you know, this very sort of detailed view based on case law about were they an independent agent or not. And the reason why, you know, the IRS cared about this was if you're going off and you're doing loan origination and stuff like this for the fund, you know, that activity gets attributed back to the fund. Okay, so when they went into court, I think the IRS had probably been prepared to argue about the business model and earning spreads and things like that. The thing the court focused on, which was sort of interesting, is they focused on the fact that the management company was charging, you know, amounts that were denominated as fees to the portfolio companies. So they had, you know, monitoring fees, structuring fees, you know, and things of that sort. And it's very common, I think, in the private equity world for management companies to charge, you know, fees to portfolio companies for different things. Sometimes you would view them as for services, sometimes maybe for, you know, provision of capital or other things. But very often those companies will view those fees as things that, you know, they can get and they can hold and that are not part of what they're providing for the fund. Or if they are provided for the fund, it might be as an offset to management fees and things of that sort, on the theory that if the fund is paying the management company, you know, some amount of, you know, some percentage of assets to, you know, keep the lights on, and they know that the management company is getting money coming from somewhere else, maybe they don't need that money. And so, you know, people will negotiate offsets. But I think very often when you have a management company, you know, receiving fees, they aren't always attributed to the fund. Here, the court, you know, analyzed this question of agency, you know, for the purpose of deciding whether or not fees received by the management company could be attributed to the fund. And that was sort of the first question is, you know, if the management company is out, you know, getting fees, you know, is that the fund's income? And interestingly enough, the taxpayers came in and said, if you want to talk about agency and should the actions of the agent be attributed to the principal, you should look under, you know, common law principles. The IRS took a different view. The IRS sort of said, if someone is out there doing something on your behalf, they are your agent, or at least that's an oversimplified description of the IRS's view, but that was sort of how it was described in the case. The court sort of rejected the IRS's, you know, view as almost certainly too broad, but then went on to rule for the IRS really on sort of two different grounds. The first one is in documentation in the case. The taxpayer, you know, the fund had hired the management company and it said the management company shall act as your agent. And so the court said, well, if you're describing it as your agent in your own documents, the burden of proof would then be on you to describe, you know, to say that they are not your agent. And you haven't done that. The other thing that the court focused on was the fact that there was this provision sort of strongly suggesting that the fund could change its instructions to the management company, you know, sort of in the middle of the fund term. And they put a lot of weight on this notion that if I hire you to do a job and I give you instructions at the beginning of the job and I'm not allowed to tell you anything ever again about the job until the job is done, then you're a service provider and not an agent. But if I'm allowed to call you up, you know, and change my instructions or tell you to do different things, apparently that is a very big factor in creating an agency relationship, or at least that's what the tax court said in this case. I think a lot of people thought that was not very intuitive. I'd never heard that distinction given so much weight before. And obviously, you know, as a lawyer or any kind of service provider, I mean, you have people that you don't think of as your principals. But if they hire you to do a job and they call you up when the job is sort of halfway through and, you know, tell you that they have a different idea, you know, you're probably going to listen to them and you're probably going to do what they say. And I don't normally think of that as creating an agency relationship where one otherwise would not have existed. But what the court did is they said, okay, there's an agency relationship here. So what the agent does is attributed to the fund. The agent is out there receiving these structuring fees and monitoring fees and other kinds of fees. And so if they're receiving those fees, that activity should be attributed to the fund as well. Also, because the agent, the management company, was using those fees to offset its own expenses. And then when it had extra, you know, money, it had the ability to, you know, give some of that to the fund, which it did from time to time. And so the first thing the court said was, okay, whatever the agent is doing, we think should be attributed to the fund in this circumstance. And then what is the agent doing? The agent is receiving all of these payments that are denominated as fees. If that's the case, then it's doing something for the portfolio companies other than just putting out its capital. It must be doing something else. And it's also interesting, the court found, that the fees are being paid to the management company, not to the fund itself, even though the fund was the one providing the capital. And so that was also viewed as evidence that these fees were for something other than just an investment. And so the taxpayers came in and they argued very strongly that, you know, was not the case, that these fees were not for services. Some of the arguments they made, I think, were, you know, less persuasive. Like they'd said there was, you know, something called a monitoring fee. And they said, how could it be a monitoring fee? There was nothing to monitor, which I think led the court, you know, to say, you know, you're basically telling us that your labels are, I think the language was, you know, at best misleading, at worst downright deceptive. But they also had, you know, various executives from the portfolio companies who showed up, and they basically said, we didn't view the fees as something extra. We were just trying to raise capital, and we viewed all of these costs as part of our cost of capital. In any event, the court effectively said there is a burden of proof that has to be met by the taxpayer that, you know, these fees are not, you know, for services. The taxpayer did not, you know, meet that burden, and therefore we think that you're providing services. And that was really how they found a trader business in the U.S. So all the things I'd mentioned before about the business model and the underwriting and the lending and all of that really didn't seem to play into the court's logic. It was more based on this notion of fees. And I think that's one of the aspects of the case that a lot of people have found sort of, I don't want to say disturbing, but has definitely, you know, gotten some attention, because there are a lot of things out there that are labeled as fees that are treated for tax purposes very often as amounts for capital, right? They're you know, commitment fees, for example, you know, very often are treated as just reducing the issue price of debt. And there are fees that might be given to someone for providing a service. There are other fees that might be given to someone, you know, for providing capital, they're standing ready to provide capital. And the court didn't really get into any of that. They just sort of used the word fee and found that something other than investing must be going on. And therefore, the taxpayer had a business, you know, had business activity in the United States.
Support for this podcast is provided by the University of California Irvine School of Law Graduate Tax Program. This preeminent and innovative program prepares students to practice tax law at the highest level in the U.S. and abroad. Featuring a low student-to-faculty ratio, cutting-edge technology instruction, and dedicated career support, UCI's graduate tax program helps prepare students for a future in tax law. Program graduates are placed in top tax-related industries, practicing law in many major U.S. cities. Applications are open now. For more information and to apply to this highly selective program, visit law.uci.edu/gradtax. That's law.uci.edu/gradtax. Now, you mentioned that there's been a fair amount of discussion. What are the biggest issues people are talking about out of this case?
I think one thing people ask a lot about is this notion of fees. Because a lot of times, again, if you have a management company that might receive fees, sometimes they might be viewed as fees for services, sometimes they might not. If you're part of a loan syndication, for example, you know, you might take, you know, what are called points or fees for, you know, standing ready to buy a loan. And I don't think anyone thinks that's for providing a service other than making your capital available. But yeah, I think one thing people are thinking about is, you know, what are we calling fees these days? And should we be more careful about that? The other point about agency, I think, was also interesting, because I think that if, for example, you have a management company that is, you know, giving you recommendations as a fund and picking investments, and then they're also, you know, getting other kinds of income from the side, you might not necessarily view that activity as attributable, you know, to the fund, unless it's sort of integral to what they were doing for the fund. And in this case, it's possible that it could have been. I don't, you know enough about the specific deals they did and how the fees related to the investments. But I think there's also that notion of the agency relationship. And I think a lot of people, you know, after the case went out, you know, went and tried to make sure or see if they, you know, had anything in their documents, you know, stating that that the management company was the agent of the fund. And I think, you know, usually the documents say the opposite, or at least a lot of them do. I think some of the feedback that I've gotten from people is just the facts in the case were just very, very different than what a lot of people that I talk with, you know, sort of view as their standard operating model. And so for that reason, I think what people are more interested in is the way that the court came to these conclusions. Like, you know, you have ECI because you had fees, you had agency in this sort of situation. And I think that's, you know, given people some pause. The other thing that the court held that I actually have an article coming out in Tax Notes in a couple of weeks describing was that the fund also should be treated as a dealer, as a securities dealer, subject to mark-to-market under 475. And that is something that I don't think has gotten as much worry. I don't think there are that many private equity funds or venture capital funds out there that are worried about getting put on mark-to-market because of this case. But I do think the court's reasoning there could certainly be criticized, I think, a misapplication of the regulations and the rules.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about this. You know, so this is to do with this unique business model this company was engaged in. And is it that other companies don't do that because that's just not their line of business, or do they do it specifically to avoid these rules?
No, I think most companies have it as not their line of business. I mean, when you look at what they were doing with equity, for example, the IRS, I think, called it very plainly, this is an underwriting business. This is not investing. You are underwriters, right? You are helping companies, you know, access the market by buying their stock and finding purchasers for it, right? And an underwriting business is not the same thing as what somebody does when they come and they buy equity with the intention of making a long-term bet on it, right? Now, one of the people for the company had made the same as they usually held their positions for 12 to 24 months, which, you know, is perhaps, you know, not an incredibly short term. But if you look at the case, you know, they had lots and lots of short-term capital gains, at least in the first couple of years, you know, dwarfing their long-term capital gains. And as I'd understood it from the case, they normally, like, they would require an issuer to register the stock in the public markets before they would agree to buy it. So it seemed like they clearly had the idea of just sort of touching the stock for a short period of time in the interest of making, you know, this, you know, I'll call it, you know, wholesale retail spread. And that is a very different business model than what a lot of investment funds do. I mean, I don't know anyone else who has that model in that legal form.
Is there any kind of bright line that distinguishes between somebody who's working as a securities dealer versus someone who's just merely trading?
Yes, there is. And it's been around for a long time. I think the sort of seminal case that discusses this is a case called Keemon, K-E-M-O-N. And effectively, what you need to understand about dealers is they're doing, you know, what the IRS accused the taxpayer in this case of doing, which is they're basically buying securities as a service, right? So if I'm a dealer in stock, you know, of certain companies, what that usually means is that if someone wants to sell their stock, they can come to me and I will buy it. And then I will, and if someone wants to buy the stock from me, I will sell it to them. And it's not because I think the stock is going to go up and down. I don't, you know, sell when I think it's about to drop or buy when I think it's going up in value. I'm basically doing this to provide a service of giving liquidity to my counterparties, right? In the same way that, you know, with a car dealer, right? I mean, if you go to, you know, the Toyota dealership to sell your Tercel, you know, they'll buy it from you, not because they think, you know, necessarily it's going to go up or down in value, but that's what they're there for, right? And they will sell you cars. And in a way, it's the same model applied to securities. And so the point of that is that if you are someone who basically is in the business of transacting with all comers, you're standing out there as willing to buy or sell securities to anyone who wants to do a deal with you, then that implies a very, very different kind of business model than an investor. The biggest point is if you're going to be in the business of dealing like that, dealing in securities, you need to manage your economic risk. You know, imagine someone who's in the position of just, you know, buying and selling stock. And, you know, one day everybody and their dog shows up and they, you know, make them buy, you know, some massive position in XYZ stock and no one wants to buy it from them. If they sit there and they provide that service without, you know, sort of covering their own risk, that's a very, very dangerous business model. And you're almost certainly going to go out of business at some point when the market turns against you, because you're not even buying securities based on your view that they'll go up in value. You're buying it because someone wants to sell it to you, and the same on the other side. And this is something that's also true for dealers in commodities, you know, things like cotton and wheat and so forth. And so when you're in that sort of business, you know, very often what you will do is you will hedge your position. So if I end up, you know, buying a whole bunch of stock of XYZ company, I want to protect myself if the stock goes down. So I will maybe try to sell a whole bunch of the shares the same day and buy and sell in large volumes. That's one way to do it. If I can't do that, you know, maybe I go to someone and I buy a put option. So I have the right to sell, you know, that stock to them for a fixed price. So I'm at least protected, you know, from falls below the level of that price. Or maybe I'll enter into forward contracts where I know that I can, you know, buy the stock in the future if I need it. And the interesting thing about that business model is once you're in the business of transacting with people sort of for their convenience, and then you need to have these other positions to hedge yourself, to hedge against economic risk, a realization-based system of taxation may not really work that well for you. Imagine that you have a bunch of stock, again, an XYZ company, and you, let's say, have a put right to sell that stock, right? And you put those two positions together, and as XYZ stock goes down, the value of the put right goes up, and vice versa. You know, what happens if you sell one of those positions but not the other at the end of a year? You might trigger a lot of gain or a lot of loss in one position and have unrealized, you know, offsetting gain or loss in the other position. When taxpayers, you know, used to do this for their own benefit, it was called straddles, right? And, you know, the IRS has rules to prevent that kind of gaming of the system. But what's also interesting is if you go back, you know, to sort of the most, you know, the earliest times of the tax code, you had a commodities dealers, I think dealers in cotton, discussed it in the article, who wanted to be on mark to market because they said, look, you know, we have a whole bunch of positions and we have a whole bunch of hedges, and we want to be able to get in and out of the different positions without worrying about, you know, triggering taxable gain, but not triggering taxable loss, you know, in a given year or vice versa. And so why don't you just look at our entire positions together, all the pluses and minuses, and every year just take our book of business, value it, you know, as an aggregate, and then, you know, we can pay tax, you know, based on the changes in value, right? Or at a lower of cost of market, I think is what they got at the time. And so in doing that, you create a system that avoids whipsaws, you know, either for the government or for taxpayers. And what people don't realize is that mark-to-market, at least some people don't realize, is that mark-to-market began as something that the taxpayers could elect into because it gave them a more rational way of taxing their offsetting positions. And the reason I'm mentioning all of this is because when you look at 475, which then talked about dealers and made this regime mandatory for dealers, you know, they talk about people who buy and sell securities to customers in the ordinary course of business, or enter into derivatives, you know, with customers in the ordinary course of business. And the point there is that when they say to customers or with customers, what they mean is, you know, you're doing this as a service to somebody else. And that by its nature implies that you have this hedged business model or this way of not actually taking an actual position, you know, overall in the underlying securities. And that, you know, because you were in that situation, the mark-to-market tax model is what would make sense for you. And that's why it's mandatory for dealers, although actually not all dealers. If you're a loan originator, if you just buy loans and don't hold them for sale, you know, the code doesn't require you to be on mark-to-market, I think, because you don't have this hedged situation. So mark-to-market doesn't have the same kind of logical sense for you that it might for someone running a hedged book. But also, you know, traders and others who, you know, may not be dealing with the market, you know, as a service provider, but who get in and out of positions very, very quickly, trying to take advantage of swings in the market price, they also can have hedged positions, and they're allowed under 475 to elect into mark-to-market taxation. And so the reason I'm mentioning all this again is that when the court decided, or was trying to decide whether or not this taxpayer in YA Global was a dealer subject to 475, effectively what they did was they looked at some regulations. And the regulations said, you know, if you're standing ready to enter into a position, then you are a dealer. And then they said, well, they were clearly standing ready to enter into these positions, you know, to buy this equity or to make these loans, because they went around to conferences and they did all sorts of marketing and stuff to try to meet people, you know, to lend money to or to, you know, buy equity from. And so they were clearly holding themselves out to do that. And that specific portion of the regulations didn't actually mention the word customer. And so they said, well, then we think that the customer is the person, you know, for whom you stand ready to do this. That person is sort of by definition your customer. And I think, and therefore, you know, you have customers and therefore you are a dealer. And that was, I think, in a nutshell, how they concluded that YA Global was a dealer and should be marked to market. And my problem with that logic is I think it reads out what it really means to have a customer. It reads out the implication of what that business model is, why mark-to-market is appropriate. And it's interesting that when the IRS, you know, in their brief was making this point, they, you know, made it very clear that in their view, in the government's view, to understand what the term customer meant, you had to understand the business model, you know, of the person interacting with the quote customer. So I think there was a whole bunch of context about the dealer regime and why mark-to-market is there that the court, you know, effectively overlooked. And part of the article was just to sort of set the record straight on that, because I think it's context that shouldn't be lost.
Now, we have this opinion out here, and this company has kind of its own unique business model. Are there other impacts we might find for the tax community at large?
I think it's too soon to say at this stage. I mean, I think a lot of people, as I say, have looked at it. I mean, there were also points about there are procedural issues. YA Global had filed, you know, 1065s where it didn't seem to record any ECI. And the tax court held that, you know, because they hadn't filed the withholding forms, 8804, the statute of limitations hadn't run. Those are sorts of things that people can probably correct. You know, if they really don't think they have a trader business, they can, you know, file the forms. And I imagine the IRS may see a lot more of those forms than they had seen in the past, now that it's been clear that you need to do that, I guess, to get the statute of limitations to run. In terms of the way most of my clients view their business model, I don't think they've felt a huge need at this stage to sort of retool. I think most people, you know, most of them would say, look, you know, when we invest in companies with an idea towards making a gain, we normally don't buy publicly traded stock at market discount with the intention, you know, of flipping it. If we make loans, you know, we're very, very careful. We either acknowledge that it's a trader business and we block it and we tell people that we're in a trader business, or if we don't want to be in a trader business, you know, we're very careful about the number of loans we might make, or, you know, careful not to, you know, negotiate the terms of loans with specific borrowers, you know, and things of that sort. So I think a lot of the things that the taxpayer had done that, you know, sort of got the IRS's attention were things that, you know, a lot of people sort of view as not what they do. When you get into this other point about, you know, you had things called fees and you had this agency relationship and so forth, I think that did get people's attention. I'm not sure, you know, people can probably change how things are labeled. They can document, you know, what payments are for, you know, perhaps more, you know, and things like that. But I think there's also sort of a view that, you know, my view is that you shouldn't take the court's reasoning to, you know, any great extreme for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, when they said, you know, you received fees and that was a business activity, they didn't get into the question of what kind of fees, you know, were they, or could the fees have been viewed as outputs for capital or anything like that. They just sort of said, we have these amounts that are labeled as fees. The burden of proof is on the taxpayer. The taxpayer did not meet that burden of proof. And they didn't really, you know, get into the substance of what the fees might have been for in a way that, you know, would have allowed someone to kind of distinguish different kinds of fees. And I think for that reason, you know, maybe people view, you know, the reasoning as maybe incomplete in that sense, right? Like if I'm, you know, buying into a syndicated loan and I get to buy at a slight discount and they call it points, I don't think there's anyone, you know, because of this case that thinks that they're engaged in a trade or business if they invest in a syndicated loan on that basis. So I think at this stage, I don't think it's changing a lot of behavior in the market. I think people are interested in the case. They're looking at it. I guess the case is still, you know, subject to appeal. It's been 90 days since it came out, but it's not final yet, I guess, because they're still deciding questions about the 2009 taxable year. But maybe at some point the case will be appealed and some of these points will be, you know, discussed more thoroughly.
Well, it's definitely going to be an interesting case to keep an eye on. Bill, thank you so much for walking us all the way through that.
My pleasure.
And now, coming attractions. Each week we highlight new and interesting commentary in our magazines. Joining me now is Senior Executive Editor for Commentary, Jasper Smith. Jasper, what will you have for us?
Thanks, Dave. In Tax Notes Federal, Emily Shi and Chai-Ching Huang study three comment cycles of the IRS Priority Guidance Plan to determine what types of commentators weigh in. Jed Bodger argues that tax practitioners have unique ethical duties that require extraordinary skills. In Tax Notes State, Darian Shansky and David Gamage continue to examine California's projected budget deficit and possible solutions. Ted Friedman and Ala Rakin outline the advantages of litigating state and local tax matters. In Tax Notes International, Heather Cohen reviews legislation to expand Canada's mandatory disclosure rules. Simbarashe Hamoudi examines recent changes to Zimbabwe's VAT Act. And finally, in Featured Analysis, Robert Goulder considers whether a taxpayer-friendly outcome in FARI would spark a general reformation of the IRS international information reporting penalties.
That's it for this week. You can follow me online at TaxStew, that's STEW, and be sure to follow at TaxNotes for all things tax. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for a future episode, you can email us at podcast@taxanalyst.org. And as always, if you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating or review wherever you download this podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode of Tax Notes Talk.
Tax Notes Talk is a production of Tax Notes. You can learn more about us by visiting www.taxnotes.com/podcast. When major media wants the straight story, they turn to Tax Notes. Thank you for listening, and join us again for another edition of Tax Notes Talk. Tax Analyst Inc. does not provide tax advice or tax preparation services. Nothing in the podcast constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice. A full disclaimer is included in the transcript.